You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Kasterman. It's going to be joined by all the beat writers for MLB.com from the AL Central teams. But obviously, the big focus right now is that division race. And in a span of about a week's time, the Tigers went from two games back of the Royals to essentially two games up, as we're all you kind of have to add a loss to the Royals total, given that they're down two in the ninth inning of a game, a suspended game. They'll be picked up on September 22nd. So we've got to keep that in mind. But in general, we're just seeing that veteran Tigers team that's been here so often and has so much superstar talent on its roster really rising to the occasion here in September. The Royals, meanwhile, are just trying to fight to hold on. They've had a rough go of it here lately, had a really tough series against the Red Sox where they dropped 3-4. And you wonder what those teams that haven't been there, as the race tightens up, do they tighten up? So we'll see how they play down the stretch here. And the Indians have kind of, I think we can all acknowledge, the Indians have played themselves out of this division race at this point, having dropped three over the weekend in Detroit. So it's down to a two-team race, and it's an interesting one. It's as interesting as any, just given all the factors at play here, with a Kansas City team trying to get back to October for the first time in 29 years, and a Tigers team with a lot of veteran talent trying to fend them off. So we'll talk about all that. Thanks for tuning in. Here we go. Joined by Jason Beck and the Tigers. Boy, we've seen it before from this team. A veteran team, a been there, done that kind of team. A lot of leadership, a lot of proven performers in the clutch, and they really stepped up at this point in the schedule where, three games at home against the Royals and three against the Indians, and they won five of the six to once again assert themselves at the top of the AL Central standings. And you look at their schedule going forward, and you look at the way things are trending, and it's easy to believe they might hold on to that spot. But let's bring him back to talk about it. Jason, do you just see, we talked a little about last week, the confidence in this club that was shaken a little bit in August, but I'd have to imagine after the way the last week has gone there, they have to feel pretty good about the way things are trending.
Yeah, I think to some degree, these guys were waiting for the Royals to come in. I got that sense talking with you guys, and they certainly performed up to that. It took a tremendous outing from James Shields to kind of shut them down there. And then, just when you wonder about a letdown, against Cleveland, even though, Cleveland's still on the periphery of the race, they come up with some pretty good games. It took some comebacks there, but you get the sense with this team, and I kind of get this sense, kind of had this sense for a few Septembers in a row here that, that these guys know how to concentrate their at-bats and hone their focus when they know the games mean the most. I think, Torrey Hunter called it September. So, they're kind of taking the playoff-type focus in September right now. Just as you thought they were able to, but you wondered if they would.
Yeah. Well, looking at this coming weekend, a chance to maybe nail it down in Kansas City, a team they've played so well against. As we sit here today, as we're recording this, Lobstein's scheduled to start that first game in Kansas City, but, there still remains a possibility of working off the off day and having their big guns, having Verlander, Scherzer, Purcello lined up for that series. There's kind of pluses and minuses to that, obviously, but those guys are more experienced. But at the same time, do you want to take the opportunity to give them extra rest before what you hope is a long October? What's kind of the thinking there, do you think, as we get closer to the weekend?
Well, Brad's not tipping his hand, Brad Ausmus, but I'd be awfully surprised if we saw Lobstein starting a game in that series. I think, there's just too much on the line, and I think there's too much benefit to moving guys up. The one factor you wonder about is Verlander had that blah look to his pitching on Sunday, where the fastball didn't look like it had a whole lot of life to it. The secondary pitches, there was movement, but the command wasn't quite there. He had kind of that look where you wonder if maybe he could benefit from an extra day off, but I just the risk reward there. I got to think that they move everybody up and just give them a chance to kind of take care of the Royals and get that done, and then kind of address extra days, in that final week of the season if they have the chance. It's entirely possible, and I wrote about it on Sunday, that, if Anibal Sanchez stays on track, you might not even need Lobstein for a start the rest of the year. If you can get him back in time to be ready when they need a fifth starter, I think that last Tuesday of the regular season.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, Sanchez at one point was written off for the rest of the year, but he's been doing his long toss. He's progressing the bullpen sessions this week. He has nowhere to get stretched out at this point in a game situation, aside from these artificial simulated games they could put together. But certainly a big turnaround but a big turnaround just in possibility of seeing him again before year's end.
Yeah, at first there was a stretch there where I just thought, they're kind of checking to see if there's any possibility. And I thought, they're just kind of going through the motions. And just when I was about to kind of downplay the possibility, Sanchez not only starts making progress, but you start seeing some real enthusiasm about how he feels and about the possibility of getting back. I think this is as upbeat as I've seen him, since before the injury. When he was working his way back before, he was optimistic, but you didn't quite see that enthusiasm. He's kind of bounding around and thinking that he's got a chance to really, work his way back into the picture here and actually be ready for to start and end the regular season and play a role in the postseason now.
If the Tigers hold on here, Ausmus is going to have, one of the more interesting dilemmas, if you can call it a dilemma, of any manager in baseball, just looking at the rotation and how do you line that up. And it's something we talked about right after they acquired David Price. You got Price, Porcello, the way he's pitched this year. Scherzer obviously is a lock. Scherzer and Price are definite locks, but Porcello has obviously pitched himself into that postseason rotation picture. And then you look at Verlander, he's still not his old sharp self, and that's understandable given what he's pitching through. But it's going to lead to a hard choice for Ausmus. What to do there in the rotation? I don't think we've talked about this, Beck, but what's your opinion on the idea that's been floated? I believe Matthew Leach, our guy Matthew Leach, wrote this for Sports on Earth last week. The idea of Verlander as a postseason ace, a la Tim Lincecum 2 years ago. Is that something that's even remotely on the table, or how do you think that plays into Ausmus's mind?
I think it's an intriguing possibility. I think it's kind of, while Sanchez has been sidelined, it's been on the back burner.
Right.
Until fairly recently, it didn't even look like you would have an option there as far as how to slide your rotation. I think a lot of it's going to hinge on, can you get Sanchez ready in time to get two starts in that final week? I don't know if one start is enough to judge him on postseason readiness. I think if you get him one start, then to me, you almost have to look at Sanchez as a guy you bring in, like a piggyback reliever or that one or two winning guy in October. If you can get him two, you give him that second start to stretch out a little bit, see if he can go six innings. I think that makes a world of difference in your mindset. And I think Sanchez could do either one. I think Sanchez is pretty flexible that way. I do think Verlander could be that type guy. It would be interesting to see what that fastball would be like if you give him a single inning. I guess if you look back to KC in that All-Star game a couple years ago where he threw 101, I don't think you could do that. But, I think you could certainly see like a 97-98 out of him. The question is, and I've noticed this the last few starts with Verlander, is can you get him ready to a point where he is sharp from pitch one? Because it seemed like the last few starts, You've seen an awful lot of fastballs that are like 90 to 91. And I don't think that's entirely, you know, just a matter of pacing himself. I think he's trying to look and to see what he's got when he goes out there the first time. He's exploring and kind of gauging to see what pitches are working on that particular day. And that's a little scary for me when you're talking about, you know, a guy that you're debating whether to bring in as a reliever in tight situations.
Yeah, it used to be his MO early in games, don't want to say playing around, but you know, feeling things out a little more and then bringing down the hammer late, whereas I just don't think he's physically in a spot to do that, to have that mentality and that mindset anymore. But back another issue, and this is, you know, maybe an underrated issue or maybe people are starting to pay attention to it, but Alex Avila and just the number of hits to the head this guy has taken the last few years, and now we're at a point in the season where, you know, early September he gets the foul tip off the mask in Cleveland and misses a few games. It sounds like he's dealing with a little lightheadedness as we speak here today. You know, this is a guy who's obviously a big part of what they do behind the plate and calling the games with these guys, but also, you know, he's had his big moments. He had a huge home run in the Saturday game against the Indians. He had that jumping catch against the net last Friday. But you got to worry about this guy. He's taken so many knocks to the skull. You wonder about his long-term health, obviously, and you also wonder about his availability for October and how that might play into this. What are your thoughts on him at this point?
You know what? This has been a huge discussion in Detroit the last couple of years, just watching the physical beating he's taken and just the frequency of the head injuries. I think this is at least 3 years now where he's had at least,
right,
you know, one episode. And this is the second one this year, really. And it's the second one, more importantly, the second one in a short period of time. And you can tell the way that Brad talks about, you know, Alex Avila in his situation, that he's worried about. And this is the guy who caught 17 years in the big leagues and expects that he did have some concussions along the way and had to play through them. And I think Brad, looking at that from his perspective, is really worried about this. And I think he's trying to use an abundance of caution. You know, long term, I think it's huge. And I think a lot of Tigers people are concerned about this. You know, for one thing, he's part of the family. You know, his dad is the assistant GM, as a lot of people who criticize Alex Avila are quick to point out. But secondly, he's not even 30 yet. He's had a number of concussions, and you wonder what can be done to protect him here. And just, it was a weird setup on Sunday, just because, you know, there wasn't one of those obvious foul tips or anything that knocked him over. He had to pick off. He got picked off at first base, and the swipe tag at first kind of got him in the noggin. And he stood up, and he kind of, if you watch the replay, you look at him, and it's like he's a little bit, I don't know if shaken up or just, he had to kind of get his bearings there for a second, it looked like. And then later on, I guess he took a foul tip, and just, the foul tip was so uneventful, I don't know if any of us even noticed when it happened. I'm sure people caught it on TV. But then when you hear about headaches as he's stepping to the plate, you know, in a key situation like that, I mean, that's scary stuff. Even if it's just lightheadedness now and he's not showing concussion symptoms, you know, this is, when you start accumulating stuff like this in a short period of time, you wonder if he might be one of those guys where, you know, if they were somehow able to clinch early, if they give him a few days off and just kind of let him clear his head. They've done a lot of stuff with him the last year or two to try to ward off head injuries like this. He's got one of those cooling helmets that he wears, you know, after he takes any impact off the head. You know, it's one of these, I guess, a state-of-the-art type of system there. No, he's got other ways to measure. The trainer watches him like a hawk after things happen, which is, you know, kind of makes it a little bit surprising that this kind of got through. But at some point, they can only do so much, and you got to wonder if, you know, maybe resting him here and there, you know, might alleviate some stuff.
Yeah, and he's got the right guy in his corner in Ausmus, who obviously has been there and been through some of these issues himself. But yeah, I think it is the cumulative effect when you, I mean, that ball in Cleveland really dazed him. He really looked dazed and confused after that, and then a week later they had more of those issues, as you mentioned, the swipe tag and another foul tip. You just worry about the guy. So we're all pulling for him just as a person. He's a good guy. Been a big part of this Tigers team the last few years, and certainly hope he can be at full health and capability, assuming the Tigers do nail down this division, which, as we sit here today, they're in really good shape to do that. So I want to thank Jason Beck for joining us, joined by Dick Cagle. And the Royals have really seen their AL Central hopes take a hit just in the past week. They went from two games up to a game back in the loss column, and you add in the suspended game against the Indians and the possibility of a loss there. It's potentially two back in the loss column going into the new week. That's not a position they want to be in. They wanted to do a better job against the Red Sox this past weekend. They dropped 3 of 4. Let's bring in DK to talk about that. Dick, how rough was that series for the Royals? I mean, at a point where every game counts, you know, that was obviously one you'd like to see them, you know, take care of business.
Well, yeah, they went in thinking, oh, we should win 3 out of 4, and they ended up losing 3 out of 4. So that was pretty disheartening for the guys. You'd think, they lost the first two, and then they came back, and the offense was churning again. They won 7-1. They were getting some hits. And you figure, well, okay, give them a little momentum going on Sunday. But as you know, in baseball, sometimes momentum doesn't mean too much. They had a real good second inning, 4 runs, and then boom, nothing. So, it was an unpleasant weekend, put it mildly, for the Royals. They have the White Sox coming in, so maybe they can fatten up a little bit there. But they've got to get the offense going, that's for sure.
Well, Ned Yost made some changes with the offense over the weekend, shaking up the top of the lineup. We had talked last week about Omar Infante having struggles in the number two spot. He moved Infante down, had Escobar at the top of things, and then Aoki, and then Kane. A little more speed there at the top of the order at that alignment. It worked that game. They scored 7 runs, and the game on Sunday, they scored 4 runs early. They didn't do anything late. But do you think that lineup is one he's going to stick with here for a little bit?
Well, it's hard to tell. I think he likes Escobar at the top. At least Esky told him the other day. He said that first day that Esky was in the leadoff spot, he grounded out in one of his at-bats on a 3-2 pitch, and he came in and he told Ned, he said, that was a strike. And Ned says, I know. And he said, if that was a ball, I was going to take it. And the inference there, of course, is that Esky is a free swinger.
Yeah.
But he knows when he's batting leadoff, he needs to take some pitches and be more selective. So that was his message. He goes,
yeah.
I think, he only had one hit yesterday, only got on base once. But he might go with this a little longer. He likes Aoki up there, either in the 1 or 2 spot. Actually, Norrie has been one of the most consistent hitters since the All-Star break. So I don't know. I don't know how long he's going to stick with this. It's a big unanswered question. He had the Kane in the 3-hole. Lorenzo is a good, hard line drive hitter with good speed and can do a lot of things. So we'll see. And he has Garden in the 4 spot. I think Gardo's starting to come around. He had a real bad there streak, 0 for something or other, 0 for 20 or 21 there for a while. But he looks like he's starting to hit the ball. So we'll see how it goes. I don't know whether he's going to stay with that lineup or do a little rejuggle, perhaps, for the White Sox series.
I saw Aoki was a little evasive when it came to talking about adjustments he's made at the plate, but obviously he's adjusted something because he has. He's been so big for them in the second half.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He smiled. And I want to ask him, through his translator, what changes did you make? And he didn't need a translator for that. He just said, top secret. So he has a sense of humor.
Yeah.
Sense of humor about it. But and, you know, and oddly, coming in the last couple of weeks here, the unanswered question is how they're going to use Billy Butler, because
right.
Billy's been sitting out quite a few games. He, you know, he got so hot there when Hosmer was out, and Billy was playing first base, and all of a sudden Billy was looking like the old Billy, and then it seemed like he kind of regressed again, and just hasn't been able to get going. And with these games being so important, Ned says, "Well, I like to go with a hot hand." Generally, that is meant that when he's healthy, has been Josh Willingham, and Billy's been Chipman. But then, of course, now in the last couple of days, he had Aoki in there in the DH. So it'll be interesting to see how they're going to use Billy. They'd love to have Billy get going, but for Billy to get going, he's going to have to play.
It's amazing how quickly that turned around. I mean, a month ago, Billy Butler's on the regional Sports Illustrated cover as kind of a representative of the Royal surge, and here we are, just a couple of weeks later, and he's struggling with the playing time, and I'm sure that doesn't help his confidence or any way he does get in there. He seems like he's on such a short leash. I saw that. It was funny to us. I'm sure. I don't know if it was as funny to Ned Yost or the Royals PR department, but I saw a fan got into the Ned Yost press conference one night and asked about Billy Butler's place in the lineup or lack thereof.
Yeah, that was actually kind of humorous. It wasn't, like you say, I'm sure it wasn't humorous to anybody else but in the Royals organization. But, the fan just kind of wandered in to the interview room, and, you know, questions were going on, and all of a sudden the guys would hear this unfamiliar voice saying, "What about Willingham and Butler? Why ain't Billy playing?"
Maybe it was one of Billy's relatives. I don't know.
Well, yeah, or somebody said maybe it was Billy in disguise, but Ned just chuckled, and he did answer the question and said, by the way, that I think Butler will be in the lineup tomorrow. Well, we found out the next day the reason Butler was in the lineup is because Willingham had pulled his groin in his last bat. So. He didn't give us a full answer there, but at least gave us a partial answer because of the fan question.
Yeah.
It was kind of humorous, but I'm sure security's a little tighter now.
Well, Ned's press conferences of late have had some interesting moments. Obviously, he's come under a lot of scrutiny. There was the base running situation in Detroit, inserting Dyson and trying to be aggressive there, and Dyson got picked off. There was the bullpen management on Sunday, the decision to have Aaron Crowe face Daniel Nava, and we saw how that turned out with the grand slam. Ned's just the guy who's kind of always in the crosshairs, and I'm sure a lot of that, you know, dates back to what happened in Milwaukee in 2008 when he got dismissed with about 12 games left in their playoff run. Just as a guy who observes him on a near daily basis, how do you think he's holding up here in the September stretch and the scrutiny? And obviously there's just that weight of expectations and anticipation just with Kansas City going so long between playoff appearances, that kind of takes on a life of its own. How do you think he's holding up through that?
I think Ned's holding up very well. As you may know, a couple of the beat reporters meet with him privately before his general session with the media every day, and you know, he's very calm, very collected, very forthright. He doesn't show to me any signs of feeling any pressure or any undue force from the outside or anything. Ned, I really respect Ned. He's a good, solid baseball guy. He has his ideas. He's kind of set in his ways. He doesn't like to juggle a lineup as he did a couple of days ago. But he saw the necessity and did it, and at least for one day it worked. But he's set in his ways, there's no doubt about it, and he doesn't apologize for it. As he said yesterday, Crow is my six-inning guy, and Herrera is my seventh-inning guy. And that's the way he played it. And it cost him, as it turned out, because, you know, as he said, Crow gave up the grand slam. But he's sticking by his principles, what he believes, and he's sticking with what got him there. So I think there's something to be said for that. I have a lot of respect for that, Yost.
On that note, and bullpen rolls and sticking with who got you there, obviously we know who the ninth inning belongs to. Greg Holland came back in the Friday game against the Red Sox, and he was getting up to about 94 miles an hour, which is encouraging given that the triceps issue that held him out for a little bit. But it seems like he'll be strong and good to go for the stretch run.
Yeah, I think so. I think they're still going to maybe let him decide on his next outing whether he wants to, you know, come in there full bore in the tight ninth inning situation, or whether he wants to try it one more time, make sure everything's working right. So I think they're kind of maybe leave that up a little bit to Holly and the game situation. But I think, yeah, all indications are he's fine. He says he feels fine. He's doing great.
Well, it's as rough as the past week has been for the Royals. Ahead of them is after the series against the White Sox, of course, is the big series at home against Detroit. Chance to do damage head to head, and they've got their veteran starters lined up for that. So, the Royals are definitely not out of it yet by any stretch of the imagination. But they definitely have to show a sense of urgency here these last 2 weeks. And want to thank Dick Cagle for joining us, joined by Jordan Bastian. And Indians are coming off a brutal weekend in Detroit where, you know, coming off the high of a two-game sweep of the Twins at home and still clinging to life in the AL Central race, really got out of hand for them over the weekend, losing some late leads and losing a late lead on Saturday and on Sunday get the sweep completed. And that could be all she wrote for the Indians and their playoff hopes. They're going to have to really have a sensational last couple of weeks of the season to get in. Jordan, what was your sense, you know, coming off of that weekend? I guess people always ask this question, but the atmosphere in the locker room, the thoughts in the locker room, it had to be a really tough go for them.
Yeah, it definitely was. And I think, you know, just talking to some of the players after the Tigers swept the Tribe, you know, I mean, they weren't sugarcoating anything. I mean, the reality is now you basically need to win as many games as humanly possible, or, you know, that's all she wrote. So, you know, a year ago, the Indians needed a miracle to get in, and they got one, but I'm not sure this team, as it's currently made up, is in a position to pull off, you know, something similar. That was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime type run in September, finishing the season on a 10-game winning streak. I think that only been done three or four times in baseball history to, you know, the way the Indians did it. You know, that was such a rare thing, and the Indians have said all year this year, we can't rely on a 10-game winning streak, you know, to finish the season to get into the playoffs. And here they're sitting, and that's basically what they need. So, you know, they put themselves in a tough position. Obviously, throughout this season, there's been so many injuries, so many young players, so many down years for key guys. You know, a lot of things have contributed to a situation that might have knocked another team even further down than the Indians are. So I think they've actually kind of overachieved to be in the thick of the playoff race as long as they have been this year.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, certainly the last couple months playing with so many young guys in the lineup on a consistent basis. But, you know, you mentioned key guys who didn't really step up, not just in this stretch, but this is the season. Jason Kipnis has been you know, a real lightning rod for that sort of criticism, just because he's had a really down year coming off the contract extension, and down here in the final stretch of September, hitting about 200, no home runs, no RBI, hasn't hit a home run since July 31st, in fact. So you really got to be concerned about, you know, where his power has gone, and defensively at second base, he's had his issues as well. There was the issue over the weekend where he gets into it on Twitter with a fan, which was just not a good look in general, but Francona kept riding him in the fifth spot. Hasn't taken off there here at the end of the season. But what's kind of the read on Kipnis' season? What do you think's going on with him? I know he had the oblique injury earlier in the year, so maybe that's something that's lingered. But you know, what are your thoughts on him?
You know, we talked with him last week, kind of about a variety of those issues that you mentioned. And one thing is, you know, he said he actually does now, and again, this is easy to say in hindsight, but he feels he put too much pressure on himself after signing the long-term extension, where, you know, a player can take it two ways: of now I can relax and just focus on baseball, or now I need to really live up to the expectations. And he thinks that he personally kind of just put too much on his own shoulders, and that got him off on the wrong foot. And then obviously the oblique injury really complicated things. And I do think that has lingered throughout the season and affected his power. I think it's really the only explanation for the dramatic drop-off in the slugging percentage. And, you know, just from watching him on a day-to-day basis, you know, what he did so well last year is he would take that outside pitch, you know, and extend and kind of go opposite field and have so much power to the opposite field gap and off left field walls. And that just hasn't been there this year. And that's the type of pitch that he injured himself on in Anaheim, was, you know, swinging at an outside pitch, hurting that oblique. Talking to David Murphy, who suffered a right oblique injury recently, he said the same thing, that, you know, pitches that are inside where he can kind of drop his hands down and use his you know, the speed of his wrists and everything, you know, those pitches are fine, but it was those outside pitches that would really struggle.
You got to wonder, you know, long-term, it's going to be a question as we look towards 2015. You know, part of Kipnis' value is the offense he provides at second base. He's obviously not providing it now. You move him to an outfield spot, which is something that idea has been kind of floated out there. He was originally an outfielder when he was drafted. You know, that offensive value is negated in some senses. Obviously, what he's doing offensively this season is going to cut it anywhere on the field. But just speaking in generalities here, I just wonder, you know, Jose Ramirez, the way he's performed at short. Obviously, Lindor is their guy long term at short. They hope, they think, you know, potentially as soon as April of 2015, although Ramirez kind of buys them the ability to, you know, buy some time there. But you do have to wonder about position switch for this guy in the long frame, don't you, for Kipnis?
Anyway. Yeah, I think not only for him, but a guy like Lonnie Chisenhall as well, who has such dramatic platoon splits and also has, you know, had his struggles at third base. So, you know, I think those are two guys, two left-handed bats, two core pieces, you know, in Cleveland's view, that, you know, as we look forecasting over the next year, 2 years, 3 years, and trying to figure out how these guys fit into the puzzle, and you do have a young kid like Jose Ramirez emerging, Lindor, you know, waiting in the wings, it is an interesting concept. You know, Chisenhall has been used, you know, he's done, like, pregame work in the outfield. You know, he came up as a shortstop, so third base was not his natural position when he first came into the professional ball. You know, and he's been shown a willingness to bounce around, and, you know, so maybe that's something they look at next spring. Kipnis, obviously, as you mentioned, came up as an outfielder, so he has that athleticism. I don't think they're ready to make that type of switch yet, but you can definitely go, you know, go into spring next year, see how he looks after the off season. I know he took a little bit of heat for coming into camp a little bit, you know, thicker than he was in previous seasons, but, you know, he didn't say that was an issue, and early in the year it didn't look to be an issue. But obviously, as the season has progressed, you know, I don't know if you want to say he's worn down or anything, but, as you know, the power numbers just aren't there, and he just doesn't look like the same guy they had last year. So maybe the oblique played part of it, maybe the contract pressure played part of it. It's going to be important next year for him to kind of, you know, bounce back from this and show, you know, why the Indians invested as much money as they did in him.
On the flip side, guy who did rise to the occasion is Carlos Santana. You know, the first couple months of the season hitting below 200 and, you know, really rebounded in a big way. He's drawn his walks all year. In fact, he could become the first Indian to lead the big leagues in walks since Jack Graney. Everybody remembers that 1919 season from Jack Graney. You know, Carlos has really stepped to the forefront here again. Is it as simple as the move to first base, just more more comfortable with that position and not so not having to be so focused on the defensive work at third base. That would seem to be the easiest explanation for what we've seen from him the last couple months of the season.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously so many things that go into it, but that is, you can draw a line in his game log from the last time he played catcher to where he is now, and that's where the statistical split is. That's where it exists. So I don't think there's any question that changing roles from that third baseman slash backup catcher to everyday first baseman, I think that was a huge contributing factor. Just for his comfort level, knowing he's going to be in the field every day, you know, not having to worry about that defensive side as much. And then on top of that, all the work he put in at third base, you can see how it's translated into his defense at first. He's actually, based on some advanced metrics, been one of the better first basemen they've had there in years. So I think that has played a big role. And you know, anyone who's looking at his batting average isn't realizing, you know, how much value he's had for this team over the last this season and for the last few months specifically. He's been one of the most productive players in the big leagues in terms of his overall worth.
Well, the rotation, the work of Santana and Brantley has been about all the offense they've had for the past month on a consistent basis anyway, and it's the rotation that's really kept them, the fact that we're even talking about them as a contender in the final stretch is a credit to that rotation. And the guy who doesn't get as much attention because it's Kluber, Carrasco, Bauer, and Salazar. You know, those guys have been the main linchpins, and you think about it, and they're all right-handed. And you look at what TJ House has done, and you wonder, I mean, is this guy a left-hander that they're going to need in that rotation for 2015? He's certainly come on strong here the last couple months. His control has improved considerably, 41 strikeouts and 7 walks over his last 7 starts. You know, House went from a guy just kind of on the fringes to a guy now you look at it, you think, well, they might really have something here.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. I mean, you can find all these unique little streaks, you know, historically, but he's had 3 starts in a row with at least 7 innings, no walks, and no more than 1 earned run allowed. And, you know, 3 in a row is the longest streak of any pitcher in baseball history. He's tied that, you know, again, it's a kind of one of those unique pitching line streaks. But the last 2 guys to do it were a couple guys named David Price and Greg Maddux. So just that kind of shows, you know, in a short stretch, you know, what he can do at his best. But, you know, over the long haul this year, he's really developed into just a reliable guy who you can put in the back end of that rotation, an extremely coachable guy who, you know, Mickey Callaway, the pitching coach, has really enjoyed working with and seen evolve from a prospect that nearly pitched his way out of the farm system to a guy who's now been a key member of this rotation this year. So, you know, he's definitely an intriguing guy going forward. You know, as you're mapping out the rotation for next year, you know, you could obviously look at the free agent market and see what could they do there potentially. But right now, you look at the 5 they have in place, might be the cheapest rotation in baseball and one of the best in the American League as things stand right now. So he's definitely an interesting part of that staff, and we'll be interested to see how he fits in going forward.
Well, just wait till next year. Clevelanders are well in tune with that.
Every year, right?
But there is certainly there's definitely something brewing in that rotation. That's good to see. But as far as 2014 goes, the likes of Miguel Cabrera and Victor Martinez and J.D. Martinez just really quashed those Central Division hopes here this past weekend. So I want to thank Jordan Bastian for joining us, joined by a slightly or maybe more than slightly under the weather, but still up to podcast par, Scott Merkin of MLB.com, and talk about this White Sox team trying to make the most of this September and this season, where obviously not a playoff factor, but an important bridge season for them. Merk, another guy who's battled some, not illness, but injury, is Paul Konerko. It sounds like he'll be back for the weekend series against the Rays, if I'm not mistaken. Is that how things are looking at this point?
That was his goal right along, was, you know, to – I mean, it really wasn't like he was taking, you know, 20 games and reducing it to 3. It was probably, as he said originally, you know, 5 or 6 games that he was going to play and reducing it to 3, maybe 4. I would think Tampa is the target just because he does want to play a few games or get a few at-bats and see how it goes, see what happens when he jams himself or when he gets a ball at the end of the bat, how the hand feels. He broke the he fractured the sesamoid bone in his left hand. And just to see how it responds, because, you know, he's going to get out there the last weekend. The Sox finish with four games at home, and September 27th is Paul Konerko Day at U.S. Cellular Field. So he will be out there, I would guess, with certainty for that Saturday and Sunday. And the Sunday might be an inning or two. But knowing Paul, he wants to check a few things beforehand. So I would say, if not Tampa, for certain that Detroit series. He will play on this next road trip for sure.
That's great to hear. You know, as we're bidding adieu to Paul Konerko, we're also thinking a lot about the future, and a right. big part of the White Sox present and future is that top of the rotation with two of the better lefties in the American League, Chris Sale and Jose Quintana. First of all, let's talk about Sale, Merk. You know, you look up here at the end of the year. It's not that we've ignored Chris Sale by any means from a national perspective, but his season in some ways does sneak up on you a little bit because there's been a lot of attention obviously paid to Clayton Kershaw in the National League.
Right.
Felix Hernandez has long been considered the favorite for the AL Cy Young, and Sale missed that time earlier this year with the arm injury. But, boy, an ERA as he goes into his next start as we record this, he's got an ERA at 1.99. Last time let's see, first time since 1978 that an American League lefty has a chance to be the first American League lefty.
I think it was the last one, right? I think Pedro is the last one overall in the American League to go sub-2 in a season. I mean, just sub-2 in the American League, Anthony. You know how ridiculous that is. And,
yeah.
And like, you know, with all due respect to Felix, he's not too far behind. I think he's, like, what, 2-2-1 or somewhere in that range, 2-1-9. So it's not like, you know, Sale is lapping the pack. But I think what you pointed out earlier is totally accurate. You know, he missed the equivalent of about 6 starts with
right.
that with the flexor muscle strain, and that probably is gonna. And the fact the White Sox just aren't a good team, that's probably gonna end up costing him the award. But again, it's kind of like last year. I thought Max Scherzer got a raw deal last year because he actually won a lot of games, but also had great numbers. And we all know how the win is now, you know, the worst stat in the history of baseball for a pitcher, but I still think that he deserved it because he won a lot of games, but he also pitched great. And I think the same thing for Felix. You know, Felix has pitched great. So it's not like if Felix wins it, an undeserving player is getting it. But Chris Sale has been phenomenal. I mean, you can speed up a lot of rebuilding or reshaping or whatever you want to call it processes if you have a guy like Chris Sale at the top of the rotation.
Yeah, and one thing, and again, I'm firmly in the camp of King Felix is the Cy Young winner, unless
right. I would agree with you, too.
In the
yeah.
last 2 weeks, and I might even put Corey Kluber ahead of Sale just because he's had the full season. But having said that, one thing I like to look at for the pitchers is adjusted ERA. Baseball
right.
Reference posts that, the ERA plus. And it's interesting to look at Sale's mark going into the next start is 196. So basically that's, you know, 96 points above league average. Hernandez is 173. And I think that just speaks to the big picture point with Sale is he pitches in a ballpark that's a little, maybe a lot more tougher on pitchers than Safeco Field where Felix pitches. Those park factors are a big part of that. I think that kind of adds to the allure of what Sale has done this season. He's pitched in the American League, pitching his home games in U.S. Cellular Field. For him to do what he's done is even more impressive when you consider that backdrop.
No question about it. You know, the funny thing is, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the ballpark hasn't seemed to play as huge this year, I think just because of the goofy weather in the Midwest. I'm sorry, it's small this year. It's played a little bigger this year because of, I think, just the weather. But you don't see as many, you know, this last week we had a few, but you don't see as many like 5 or 6 home run games or as many balls that you look at and say, geez, that's a fly ball to right, and ends up 10 rows deep in the right center field stands. Right center is really the kind of wind tunnel in U.S. either. But that's not taking anything away from Chris. I mean, Chris is, I think not only has the great stuff, some of the best stuff in baseball, you know, probably right behind Clayton Kershaw in terms of best lefties in the game. I mean, you know, right up there in the team photo for best starters overall. But I think he's learned about himself a little more, and I think he handles things. I don't want to say he ever handled it bad, but I think he really has kind of become a veteran. You know, he just understands that. A great example is he had that game in Anaheim earlier this year cruising along, gets into the eighth, and I think he literally gave up 5 runs on 5 hits, including a Mike Trout grand slam to end the rally. And he was upset when he left. I think he hit a couple light fixtures on the way out. But after the game, he had calmed down, and he kind of can separate things a little bit. You know, and I think that's a good guy to have at the top of your rotation. And really, people have talked about him becoming kind of the leader with Konerko gone, but he will be one of the leaders. And there's no question he is that with the pitching staff right now.
You know, if Sale kind of falls a little under the radar just as a product of being on a, you know, a sub-500 team, then Quintana really falls under the radar as a product of being in the shadow of Sale in that rotation. But his last start against the Twins, 7 innings, strikeout 13, struck out 6 in a row at one point. And going back to June 19th, which is a, you know, pretty sizable sample, he's got a 2.74 ERA. So it's a little unorthodox that their top two starters are both left-handed, but if it's those two guys putting up a 1.99 ERA, or in Quintana's case, a 2.74 ERA over a span of a few months, I'm sure the White Sox will take that.
Well, but before we go to Quintana, I just happened to call it up here on Baseball Reference. Chris Sale, lifetime at U.S. Cellular, 27-14, 2.72 ERA.
Wow.
That's pretty darn good. That you're taking care of business if you're doing that at USA. Mark Burley used to be like that, where he just, you know, had what it took to succeed there, and that's a big part. But, yeah, Quintana, I think, you know, gets hurt by the fact that he's got, like, 39 no decisions since 2012, which leads baseball. And it's interesting because he's another guy who's really, you know, he was given up by the Yankees and a couple scouts, you know, from the White Sox. Duraka Shaheed was one of them, I know, that kind of found him, you know, scouting him and recommended the Sox to sign him. And, boy, it's been, you know, one of their great under-the-radar pickups. And the strange thing there is, you know, if Carlos Rodon breaks camp with the team next year, then you have 4 lefties and maybe Noesi, or, you know, maybe another starter they go out and get who will be a righty. But here's the thing, and you can chime in on this, do you go with 4 lefties as long as they're good? You know, Don Cooper, the pitching coach of the White Sox, and Rick Hahn always said, you know, we'll take 6 lefties if they're accomplished. Or do you need to trade one of them and get another right-hand starter in there? And here's the thing, you're not going to trade Sale. You're not going to trade Rodon. John Danks, who's a solid innings eater, if not having the year he wanted, has $28 million left over 2 years, so it's going to be very tough to trade him. Mm-hmm. So then do you look at Quintana, who would get you a huge haul in return because he's got such a team-controllable contract right now? Or are you saying that if you trade Quintana, well, we're trading one of the best pitchers in the American League and you just can't do that? So it's an interesting situation they're going to have to decide in the offseason. And, you know, I think it's going to end up being that they're going to go with the 4 lefties and then probably find a righty to fill out the rotation.
And that's, you know, not to be negative, but that's an interesting time to go with such an arrangement or have such an arrangement. Just we've seen the dearth of left-handed power hitters in baseball in general. That was really apparent at the All-Star game and the Home Run Derby,
right,
and the All-Star game starting lineup. So, you know, at a time where
I think Adam Dunn became, you know, a needed commodity by the A's at the end of August there, because you just don't have that. You know, that's something the Sox can go out and look for in the offseason now, is a left-handed bat to hit behind or hit in between Abreu and obviously Yael Garcia. Quintana, he's got a 5-year deal, $21 million with options for 19 and 20. So that's a pretty darn team-friendly deal for a high-end pitcher like that guy. So, you know, you look at that and say, we could get a huge return, or do you say, well, why would we give away something we're just going to have to go out and fill again? So let's keep these guys at the top.
Right, and you're not trading Sale, and you're not trading...
No chance. You're not trading
Rodon. Yeah.
And Danks is just, you know, I think with the contract he has is tough to trade. But it's just harder to trade than a guy like Quintana, obviously.
Yeah. One last... We've gotten a little stat-centric on this podcast, Merck, so I do have to know one last stat here that's interesting to look here these last couple weeks of the season. But Jose Abreu, who we've talked about pretty much every week on this podcast for good reason, tied the rookie record, the team's rookie record for home runs over the weekend. But, you know, what's interesting to me, another advanced number is the OPS plus on Baseball Reference, where, again, it's measured on park factors and the league average and all that. And he could be the first rookie who qualifies for the batting title with an OPS plus of 170 or higher since, and only the second all time and the first since, Shoeless Joe Jackson in 1911.
I did not cover him, by the way. I was not covering baseball at that point when Shoeless Joe.
Is that right?
I started the year after, actually.
You were still in your internship.
Well, I mean, the Braves.
And that puts
you know,
in perspective with Mike Trout's year 2 years ago, which, again, nothing to take away from Trout because Trout's the all-around player that Abreu is not. But that puts Abreu's offensive input in some great perspective. This has been a really special season to watch. 30 home runs, 30 doubles, 100 RBI. Only three other guys have done that right. Rookie year. Really special stuff.
Yeah, you know, Konerko referred to him recently as a thinking man's hitter, and he said as good as a power hitter he is, and he's an accomplished power hitter. He tied Ron Kittle's rookie record of 35 home runs in a single season. He's even a better hitter. And it's funny, I asked Todd Steverson, the hitting coach, a while back in Boston about Abreu hitting 300 in a season. I think he was hitting about 270 then, and Steverson kind of laughed. He said, well, I'm not going to put that kind of pressure on the kid. You know, he's a great hitter. You know, he has a plan. That's been the key thing with Abreu is that he talked about this, that like from when he gets up in the morning, he has a set plan every day. And now the kid's going to finish probably in the 320s, and if not in the high 318, 319. So, yeah, an incredible year. I mean, in fairness to other rookies, you know, Abreu came in with quite a bit of experience, but he is better than the Sox expected. And as the Sox have said, they had pretty high expectations when they brought him in.
Yeah. Well, if Paul Konerko calls you a thinking man's hitter, I mean, that's coming from
that's
the it. Ultimate thinking
you,
man.
You get the trophy in that case then, I think.
Yeah. One last thing, Merk. Did you meet Garth Brooks? Garth Brooks shows up to take batting practice off Robin Ventura. Merk is a huge Garth Brooks fan. I think you saw all 12 shows at Allstate Arena, didn't you? Was it 12 shows, 11 shows? Whatever it was, you were at every one, were you not?
It was 11 shows, and I saw all but 10 of them.
Oh, okay. Well, did you get to meet Garth Brooks?
I did not. It was done under the cloak of darkness in the afternoon. No, he had like – that was it was Friday when the Sox eventually had a rainout, and he had a 6 – he did two shows tonight, which is kind of crazy seeing the energy he puts into it. And he had a 6 o'clock show in Allstate, which is out by O'Hare. So, you know, he was gone before we even got out there. But it's too bad. Robin did say – you know, Robin's known him back from their Oklahoma State days together, and Mark Parent, the White Sox bench coach, is a good friend of Garth Brooks. And Robin did say his bat is slowing down a little bit, but he had a good time. Him and Trisha Yearwood and the band came out, and they took it – judging by my Facebook feed with some of my friends I have who are with the White Sox, he took pictures of literally everyone in the organization that afternoon, it looks like, too. So a good time had by all.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. And I saw a video. It looks like it is a little slower bat speed, but he's still got a pretty good swing. You know, you think back to
he was a big deal
in the 90s. He used to show up at spring trainings and whatnot.
Yeah, Robin said that he was with the Mets in 2000. I think he was – was the Padres or the Royals he was with another time. Yeah, the one thing they said is that it's kind of like what you hear Jim Thome describe it. As good a player he is, he's a better person. And Robin and a couple other people who met him said as good of an entertainer as he is, he's a better, nicer person. So that was good to hear. Good to hear they all had fun. And I guess he shagged a few fly balls and had a good break from the performing there.
Well, he temporarily owned Chicago for a couple weeks there with those 11 shows, but now he's he has left. He gives ownership back to you, Merk, and we're all your podcast listeners are rooting for you to make a recovery from your high fever there. And we want to thank you for doing this podcast. I'm going to be joined by Rhett Bollinger to talk about a Twins team that it looked for a while like they might avoid the 90 loss threshold, although the way things have gone here, especially the last week or so, looks like very good chance of the fourth consecutive 90 loss season. Had a chance to talk to Ron Gardenhire a little bit about that last week, and he said what you expect him to say. They're not really at this point, once you're out of the playoffs, not really focused on the exact one loss record, more focused on seeing some young guys that they have to see for next year. But let's bring Rhett in to talk about that. Rhett, you know, obviously a disappointing season. More uncertainty now with the leadership and what they'll do with Gardenhire or what Gardenhire will do this offseason if he comes back for next year. But in general, what's your perception been of that 90 loss number, what it means to the guys in the clubhouse? Is it a source of frustration or something they were looking to avoid down the stretch here? Or is it just a product of playing some young guys here in the final stretch?
It's definitely frustrating. I think coming into the season, the Twins thought maybe this would kind of be the bridge here to being competitive. I don't think anyone thought the Twins were going to, you know, make the playoffs or anything this year. But I think people thought, okay, they spent some money on Nolasco, on Hughes, Pelfrey, Suzuki, added some pieces. I thought, okay, maybe kind of get us closer to 500 even to build on for the next season. Maybe get guys like Miguel Sano and Byron Buxton up here to get a taste of it. That didn't happen. You know, as we know, Buxton and Sano were hurt pretty much the entire season. Twins are en route to another 90-loss season. So in that sense, it is frustrating. I think the Twins are hoping for better. And early in the season, they had a tough schedule, and they actually kind of weathered it, and they're right around 500, you know, for the first part of the season, and it's kind of just falling apart again. And it's got to be a little frustrating for the players. You know, I think even this month, they wanted to kind of play spoilers a little bit, finish a little bit strong, and it just hasn't really happened. I think they're 2-8 over the last 10, struggled here, but they got a chance to kind of still play spoilers here down the stretch with a couple series against the Tigers and the Indians. So, yeah, I think they kind of want to finish on a better note, but at the same time, it's kind of been another season that's been frustrating for them.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you talk about finishing on a better note, I mean, obviously a lot of that revolves around the rotation and looking ahead to next year. And Trevor May's a big part of that. He had maybe his most encouraging outing yet against the White Sox this past weekend, struck out 10 of the 23 batters he faced. He had 19 first-pitch strikes, gave up 3 runs over 6 innings, but didn't walk anybody. That had to be a really good sign for him, just attacking the strike zone early.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, right now I think he's won his last 3 starts, which is a big, you know, thing for him. Obviously, he probably couldn't have started any worse than his first start there against the A's when he walked 7 guys in like an inning and 2/3 or something. So that was kind of one of those things, okay, I'm going to keep giving him chances here because his next 2 weren't much better. But he showed why he's been a highly regarded prospect. I mean, to strike out 10 guys and not walk any of them was a big step for him. You know, the Twins have only had 2 guys all year reach 10 strikeouts, and that's him and Phil Hughes. And no one had done it for the Twins, I think, in 2-3 years, which is kind of interesting that you can't get a guy to strike out 10 batters. But, yeah, the Twins are definitely a good sign for next season that May's starting to figure it out right now. If he would have scuffled all the way to the end, then you wonder, okay, is this guy, you know, what are they going to do with him next year? Is he going to start again in AAA? But if he can kind of continue that and make a couple more good starts down the stretch, I think he's definitely kind of solidifying his case to be a part of the rotation early next year. So definitely positive signs from him the last 3 times out.
Yeah, and looking a little deeper at that last start, it seemed like he had a lot of trust in his changeup, and Kurt Suzuki was encouraging him to throw his changeup a lot, and that seems like a big key for him as well, isn't it, that secondary pitch?
Yeah, absolutely. That was the thing I think in his early starts he was afraid to throw. It wasn't like throwing his changeup at all. It was misfiring with his fastball, and now it seems like his fastball commands back. He's starting to command his curveball, his changeup, some of the offseason stuff a little better. He talks about it. You don't hear it too often, but the difference in the baseball – from the minor league baseball to the major league baseball is a little different, he said. But I think his first start especially kind of had to get used to that grip, and the way the ball was spinning on him, said, was not the way it usually, you know, would for him. All of his fastballs are just kind of staying flat. And so I think for him it's kind of also important for him, not just a changeup, but just that his fastball now is getting that normal movement that he got in the minors, is allowing him to throw hard, but also to get some downward movement on it and get some ground balls too.
Yeah. Another thing, Rhett, from over the weekend, we've all had rain ruin our plans at one time or another, but I don't think any of us mere mortals have had rain cost us $500,000, which is a possibility for Phil Hughes potentially not reaching his 210-inning threshold that would trigger a $500,000 bonus. Rain washed out a game Friday in Chicago and pushed him back a day, and now he's not lined up to start the last day of the regular season like he was, but I guess the bright side of that for Hughes and for the Twins is the fact that he's anywhere near that threshold. When he signed that contract, it was, you know, I had those incentives built in and just kind of, you know, hoping that was even in play. So the fact that he's getting towards the 200 innings mark is a big encouraging thing for this rotation going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's been a great signing for this team. I mean, this guy's been an ace. If you look at, you know, stats like WAR on FanGraphs, he's top 5 in baseball right now. I mean, the guy's had a great year. I think also there's a chance he could break the all-time major league record for best strikeout to walk ratio in a season. I believe right now it's close to 11, striking out 11 batters per every walk, which is pretty incredible. And he's thrown a lot of innings. You know, I think even more so in the last month or so, as more times he's been going, you know, 7-8 innings. Early in the year, he was still kind of going 6 here and there, but he's really gotten into a groove again, and he could not have been a better signing for this team. And the best part about it is they still have him for, you know, 2 more years after this one at $8 million a year, which sounds like a bargain. And at the time, when he got the deal, it was 3 years, 24. We're thinking, okay, this guy had a 5.19 ERA last year. Young guy, was only 27, but definitely some risk. And people probably were shaking their heads like, why would the Twins give this guy 3 years? And yet now you look at it, and he was probably worth $24 million just this year pretty much. So anything else is just extra. So, yeah, it's definitely a huge signing for them and really encouraging that really, truthfully, if you look at some of these stats, these advanced stats especially, he really is pretty much an ace. And the Twins definitely need someone like that in their rotation.
Yeah, especially as they infuse some younger guys, guys like May in particular, and maybe Alex Meyer next year. You need that steady hand. There's no doubt about it. And Ricky Nolasco has obviously not been especially steady for them. That's been a disappointment. But Hughes has paid off in a big way. And the other guy who hasn't paid off yet is Tommy Malone. Was given extra rest, 10 days rest, and then came, turned up with a sore neck to further push back his next start. We talked before, Red. I mean, 5 starts, an ERA over 7, but hopefully the neck situation resolves itself quickly, and he's able to make a couple starts for him down the stretch and turn a corner.
Yeah, absolutely, and that'd be big for him, just kind of confidence wise, because even before he struggled with the Twins, he really was struggling at Triple-A, even with the A's. You never really know why. So people thought maybe the frustrations of being in Triple-A when he knew that he was a big, big pitcher, because even when he got demoted, it was because of those big trades that he's made. I mean, his ERA was still in the mid-3s, but he struggled at Triple-A right around the time of the trade. And for Twins, he struggled, and, you know, he had some shoulder fatigue, and now the neck thing. So you wonder if he just kind of obviously been dealing with some injuries in the last few weeks here. So I think the hope is that maybe he can kind of get healed up here soon, maybe make a couple starts, or at least one good one, you know, before the end of the season to kind of finish on a good note. And then next year he'll be in that mix for the rotation, and at least they have, you know, better than in years past where they didn't really have much options. At least now they have some of these options with Nolasco. As much as he struggled, he's looked a little better recently. And to have him and, you know, Meyer and obviously we talked about Hughes and May. So, I mean, there's definitely some options in there for next year, and Malone's definitely a part of that equation.
Yeah. A big source of fascination with the Twins right now is Kenneth Vargas and the way he jumped on the scene here and really showed himself to be have a knack for those clutch situations, those runners in scoring position situations. And Gardia said, you know, it's too small of a sample to read anything into that, but he's definitely shown that he can shorten up his swing if need be. But, you know, at the same time, he's also going through the adjustments. You had a nice story about him last week about the adjustments he's trying to make. Trying to increase that walk rate, trying to be more selective, trying to show he can handle more off-speed stuff. What's your overall read on Vargas? And, you know, sometimes these guys come up and they have these short spurts. You mentioned Chris Parmalee in September 2011 as an example of a guy who wasn't able to sustain that over, you know, the course of a career. What's your read on Vargas and as he's trying to make these adjustments at the big league level?
I think he's doing an okay job at it. The last week or so, he's kind of, you know, seen his average dip a little bit, closer to around 290, but he's still hitting for a good average. But, yeah, teams are definitely adjusting on him, throwing him more breaking balls, more change-ups, that kind of thing. He's going to see a lot more of those going forward because he's such a, you know, good fastball hitter. But I think the thing that works in his favor as he does is, you know, hit the ball the other way with authority a lot of times, too. He's not one of those cool, happy guys. And it also helps that he's, you know, he's not he's a switch hitter, you know what I mean? So he's not going to see breaking balls breaking away from him, you know what I mean? He's not going to – you can't have, like, as much as he's always been compared to Ortiz, if he has half the career Ortiz had, that would be wonderful. But he's not going to see – you can't bring in a lefty specialist to face Vargas to try to get him to, you know, swing at a breaking ball and diving in the dirt away from him. But Vargas, you bring a lefty, okay, well, he's going to hit from the right side, and that's what he is naturally anyway. And he's got power from both sides of the plate. So, I mean, he really is – there was a home running at a Target Field a couple weeks ago that was one of the farthest ones I've ever seen at that park. He's got about, you know, as good of raw power as anybody, it sure seems like. So I think as long as he can kind of adjust to this, I don't know if he'll ever hit for this high of an average over the course of a season, but if he can be a guy that can hit 270, 280, and start to walk a little bit, I do think that he will, because his minor league track record, he walked about 10% of his plate appearances. Up here, it's been like 2%, but I do think it's one of those things guys do that when they first get up there. They want to make an impression. He doesn't want to come up here and look like a guy just trying to take a walk when guys are on base. He wants to come up here and do some damage, but I think as he gets older and matures and works with the hitting coaches here, he'll get better at that. But I do think that so far he's been obviously very good. I do think that he can be a kind of a DH of the future, but I don't know if he'll be quite as good as he's been so far this year. But I do think the Twins still have high hopes for him.
And then one interesting thing to watch in these last couple of weeks is Gardy does want to try to work him in at first base a little bit just to, you know, see how he's progressed there. It seems like he's become a little more fluid there, but as you say, he's looking like a nice DH option for them in general as we go forward here. So
I want to thank Rhett for joining us. All right, everybody, thanks for listening. This has been MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition.